Thank you very much indeed, and thank you for coming along on a lovely day like this. We're getting to that time of the year when it's quite difficult to get people to come to lunchtime occasions, but I'm grateful to you for being here. We always have to warn guests and speakers about the fire alarm. It used to go off at 1:05 exactly, which it may well today. We had one or two speakers who were distinctly shaken by the experience and find it rather difficult to continue with their remarks afterwards. So if it goes off, we know it's only a test. I decided to try and write a pamphlet on this subject of isolation and polarisation, the West's failing agenda. And I decided that about 3 months ago, because in the time I was Shadow Foreign Secretary, and also in the years since, when I've been spending a lot of time, particularly in the Middle East, I became increasingly concerned by seeing what I regarded as Western foreign policy producing the exact opposite result to the one which they had intended at the beginning. And so I set about trying to write this pamphlet. It became quite difficult because the region that I'm talking about, which is essentially the region between, if you like, Afghanistan on the one side and the Mediterranean, the Levant and Israel on the other, is a region of changing situations, never more so than at the moment. And so trying to get a fixed position at any given time became very difficult. And indeed, some of the remarks I may make today, some of you may feel since this morning, have become less relevant than they were last night, but that's part of the problem of talking about this area. But what is certain is that after the Cold War ended, after the collapse of the USSR, after the uneasy international equilibrium which has existed during that period disappeared, Western foreign policy by and large mirrored that of America, which was really essentially a hard power approach, using its strength to impose its vision of world order. And in a sense, and to an extent, this worked. For instance, in the Balkans, I think a number of solutions there were created by this exercise of hard power. But in the fires of 9/11, the vision, in my view, became distorted and the delivery became counterproductive. And although we are now seeing belated signs of readjustment, the results of so far of this policy have been almost entirely the opposite of what was intended. And as I say, no more so than in the region which I want to concentrate on today. Here, in this region, the West has sought openly to impose its own social and political vision, and in my view, quite simply, we've got it wrong. There are two phrases above all that epitomise this failure. The first is the axis of evil, a phrase you'll remember which was originally introduced by President Bush just after the 9/11 incident. And the second, rather surprisingly, is exporting democracy. The axis of evil was a dangerous phrase because it sought to categorize the world into bad and good. It created a polarized world in which those who were not with us had to be against us, and it was at best a heavy-handed concept. Exporting democracy, in theory, sounds respectable. Allowing people to decide their own futures is, after all, a desirable objective. But the term exporting proved counterproductive. I'll just wait for a second until I think it'll do it again. I'll keep going for the moment. The term exporting proved counterproductive because it infers that the exporter's product is superior to that which it seeks to replace, when in reality, in terms of democracy, it can end up replacing potentially benign, if non-elected, regimes with often unpalatable democratic outcomes. The exporters of democracy assume that democratic processes naturally produce liberal democracies as they normally do in the West. In practice, the opposite has often proved to be the outturn. We'll get this signal again in a second. There we are. Hopefully that's it. Over these last years, the West's stock response to the axis of evil and its satellites, because the original three countries then grew in number, has been regime change followed by so-called democracy, as is seen in our continued involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan. More significantly, throughout the region, it has driven forward the process of what I call categorization, vilification, ostracization, isolation, and ultimately polarization. And in almost every case where this has been applied, the results have been the opposite of those intended, nowhere more so than with regard to Iran. At the turn of the century, Iran had few friends, threatened by external Taliban influences to the east and Saddam Hussein's malign influence to the west, Iran was anyway self-isolated by its own religious introversion, uncooperative and unfriendly. Maybe that's it. Uncooperative and unfriendly, it was a brooding menace, but as the century changed, it was little more than that. The axis of evil concept changed all that. Condemnation encouraged Iran to flex its muscles, and coupled with the unintended generosity, if I can use that phrase, of the West in disabling the Taliban threat and removing the menace of Saddam Hussein, it gave Iran a fresh persona and a stronger position within the region. And what is more, isolating the regional bad guys in some cases has brought about an almost incredible situation where Sunni and Shia are finding common cause against the United States and its allies, where unlikely friendships with Iran are being created because there is no other friendship available, and where even moderate Gulf states are protecting their backs by burnishing their credentials with Tehran. Western policy has given Iran a revived role in regional affairs, just as Western hostility towards and suspicion of Islamism has acted as a recruiting sergeant for Islamist movements. Both are now more powerful and credible than they could ever have hoped to be a few years ago. And Western policy has also created disturbing anomalies. Syria, in Western eyes, may have been regarded as part of the regional problem. In fact, it also has to be a central part of the solution. Yet it has been ostracized and isolated by the United States and other countries. Even when the Iraq Study Group report indicated a way in which Syria could become involved in working towards a regional solution, the United States and most of the West continue to hold it at arm's length. The truth is that both Syria and the West would benefit from dialogue, particularly as President Bashar al-Assad has begun to look outwards, increasingly, as I know from conversations I've had with him, seeing Syria as a Mediterranean country in terms of relations with the European Union. And it's interesting that over these last few days that has been recognized publicly by President Sarkozy of France. Syria has strategic interactions with almost every major player and country in the region. It can either be a benign or a malign force in relation to the politics of Lebanon and of the Palestinian Authority, and indeed between the Palestinian Authority and Israel as well. In relation to Iraq, Syria has a major incentive to become constructively involved in stabilization, if only to expedite the return of the Iraqi refugees who are currently undermining the Syrian economy. Yet the United States still will not talk to Syria other than on the furthest margins of other events, and it's long been against Israel doing so either. And the effect of this has been to drive Syria ever closer towards Iran, which is why arguably the most important diplomatic process at the moment is the one going on between Syria and Israel, which is moderated by Turkey. Because an agreement between the two of them, however unlikely that may be, if it happened, it would change the whole regional equation, and the repercussions of it would be enormous. While Syria would retain the friendship of Iran, it would no longer be a dependent friendship. Israel would become less insecure by the shoring up of one of its more fractious borders. A shift would occur in the Middle Eastern dynamic that could have a positive knock-on effect in breaking up anti-Israeli alliances between militant groups. It could make Syria less prone to interfere in the affairs of Lebanon, and Syria could exert a benign influence on both Hamas and Hezbollah. Even if there is no agreement, the Turkish process could offer an entry to discussions on a more comprehensive resolution of the problems of the region, one which could allow others to become part of the dialogue too. And this is a real opportunity, in my view, to turn away from isolation towards engagement. And the United States could have a positive role in this. Instead, through our policy of isolating and ostracizing, America is allowing herself, I think, dangerously to become marginalized, not only in this regard, but in other equally important and related disputes. The US is being gradually supplanted as the potentially most influential mediator by regional states, such as Turkey in the Israeli-Syrian talks, Egypt in the Hamas-Israeli ceasefire and prisoner negotiations, and Saudi Arabia in seeking Hamas-Fatah conciliation. I wish the Syria-Israel initiative well. The consequences of failure and maintained Western isolation are that Syria will continue to rely on Iran for support and friendship and will give it back in return. But Syria's presence at the Annapolis conference demonstrated that they are willing to be more widely involved, and this is what we in the West should now be encouraging. And the French have realized this. President Assad's visit to Paris this week is, in my view, warmly to be welcomed. It is time we in the United Kingdom set aside our obsolete inhibitions about Syria and also got involved. And the same applies in Lebanon. The Lebanese tragedy is that it has for far too long been the frayed rope in a political tug of war between Iran and the US and Israel and Syria. The withdrawal of Israel without conclusive victory in the summer of 2006 was regarded as a victory for Hezbollah, one which has reverberated across and around the Middle East. Opponents of the United States and Israel are noticeably emboldened by the outcome of that conflict. The failure of the West in general, and the United States and the United Kingdom in particular, to press Israel to cease her attack was at the time, and still is, interpreted as tacit support for the Israeli action in seeking to obliterate Hezbollah. Its effect was to drive Hezbollah even more firmly into the arms of Iran, which reacted predictably by helping it with the arms and welfare resources which Hezbollah needed to underline its victory. Yet the West learned nothing. This May, they tacitly encouraged the Lebanese government to seek confrontation with Hezbollah. They had vicariously helped arm the various anti-Shiite militias, thereby making Hezbollah even more reliant on similar help from Iran. They have studiously ignored the fact that there can be no constitutional government in Lebanon without the democratic involvement of Hezbollah, and that isolating them will never achieve the purpose that they're setting out to achieve. Hezbollah's actions in early May brought all this to a head. The subsequent deal at Doha in mid-May underwrote victory for Hezbollah and its allies, giving them most of what they were asking for. And once again, isolation and ostracization had achieved the opposite of what had been intended. It allowed Hezbollah credibly to present themselves as a resistance movement, as liberators and not merely defenders, and as a role model for the region. Hassan Nasrallah's allusion to a pan-Arabism and a sense of what he called shared resistance is really the fruit of the Western policy of isolationism. The solution for Lebanon has to come from within, where the major problem is still the weakness of national institutions, the inadequacy of the state, and the lack of social contract. The formation, at last, in the last 2 weeks, of a new government of national unity is, however, much to be welcomed. But this has happened despite, rather than because, of Western pressure. The West would be in a much stronger position to help if they were now prepared to engage with all the elements and to stop taking sides. And the Israeli-Palestinian conflict has been another area where the politics of isolation and ostracization have made a lasting solution, in my view, more difficult. The closeness of the United States and Israel in their relationship has of itself had a polarizing effect within the Palestinian community, and that, I think, is known by all those who visit the area. For all the various peace initiatives, including the current aftermath of Annapolis, which we're hearing more about today, the ordinary Palestinian sees the West's failure to rein in the Israeli settlement program or to condemn the barrier as clearly partisan. That is how they see it. It was the US, however, who insisted on democratic elections in the Palestinian Authority. Hamas's overwhelming victory in the parliamentary elections of January 2006 was not, however, their intended outcome. And Hamas was immediately encircled by the quartet with politically undeliverable preconditions in order to enable the policy of ostracization of terrorist movements to remain intact and, in practice, the election result to be ignored. And the regional effect of that was to destroy further the credibility of exporting democracy and once again to drive the ostracized and the isolated, in this case the Sunni Hamas, into the arms of Shiite Iran. And it took the continuing isolation of Sunni Hamas to create earlier this year the current unlikely alliance with Shiite Hezbollah. Yet engagement with Hamas remains essential because without their involvement, no peace process will ever have the required legitimacy to survive. Creating Palestinian unity must be a priority both to rein in Hamas and to create a representative Palestinian organization to take forward genuine negotiations with Israel. Local interests realize this. Countries such as Saudi Arabia, Egypt and Jordan, despite themselves being threatened internally by Islamic movements, have supported the notion of a unity government as the only way for an agreement to be reached. They have, but the West has not. We press on with the rumored Annapolis goal of what's now called a shelf agreement between Fatah and a weakened Israeli government, which, if achieved, would in my view be positively dangerous. A coconut on a shelf for everyone to shy at. And at the end of the day, I believe that that would be more damaging than no agreement at all. Despite being the historical frontier of a different empire and an adversary for much of modern times, Iraq is another arena where the politics and policies of isolation is allowing Tehran's influence to grow. Muqtada al-Sadr and his Mahdi army, alienated from the West, have strategic connections with Iran. The Prime Minister and the United Iraqi Alliance are Shia, and despite their reliance on the West, we've seen growing ties with Tehran. The crowning moment thus far for Iran's growing influence in Iraq was the visit of President Ahmadinejad to Baghdad in early March this year. It was the first by an Iranian leader since the 1979 revolution, and if you saw the film of it, the welcome was positive, it was high profile, and it was warm. And Iraq is an area where the West still exercises hard power in pursuit of building democracy. And so to me it's doubly ironic and revealing that isolated Iran should have such ready purchase there. I've long believed that the answer to the long-term stability of Iraq must involve all her powerful neighbours. But the multilateral group of Saudi Arabia, Iran, Turkey and Syria can only make headway once American polarisation ceases. Until then, I fear Iran will continue to take advantage. Other countries which are not directly caught up in the conflicts are often and wrongly overlooked in considering the overall stability of the region. Yet the long-term solidity and moderate politics of these countries cannot simply be taken for granted. Indeed, neither can their independence from Iran. The simple fact expressed to me very recently by leaders from these countries, particularly in the Gulf, was that it was all very well for the United States to call on them to back the isolation of Iran, but on the inevitable day whenever that the United States left the region, Iran would still be there, in the case of the Gulf states, as a very near neighbour. So a different, more passive form of polarisation is occurring with the same result, the broadening of the influence of Iran at the expense of the West. Kuwait is a good example. Recent elections held in May saw the conservative Islamic Salafis achieve success at the expense of the more moderate representatives. Political and social reform are made more difficult by the electoral victory of the Islamic conservatives. And it's not surprising that in these circumstances, Kuwait increasingly needs to ensure reasonable relations with Iran, which might otherwise seek to exploit the situation. The West, therefore, should not seek to force nascent Arab democracies into positions that are ultimately to their disadvantage in order to serve our own immediate international ends. These countries have a role to play, particularly in the dialogue that holds out the best hopes for a comprehensive settlement in the region. The recently successful Doha Accord, brokered by Qatar, which averted further immediate civil conflict in Lebanon, shows the enormously important role that these states can play as long as we in the West do not seek to tell them to whom they can or cannot talk. Their role must be one of engagement, which is the antithesis of isolation. Which brings me to my conclusion. The policy of isolation and ostracization, born of the concept of the axis of evil, has not worked. After 6 years far from being weakened, Iran has become an increasingly influential power in a turbulent and dangerously unsettled region. Demonization has given Iran an elevated status in a region already inclined towards anti-Americanism. Indeed, Iran has benefited from the notion that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And while there were once disparate groups with historical antagonisms, there are now disturbing elements of cohesion to be found. Isolation and ostracization have strengthened Iran and Syria and Hamas and Hezbollah. It has weakened the Lebanese government of Sinjora and the status of President Abbas on the West Bank. It has undermined the Saudi attempts to bring the Palestinians together. And it hasn't strengthened Israel nor made her safer. It's putting pressure on our friends in the Gulf, and it has not solved Iraq or Afghanistan. It has, if anything, widened the disparity of these disputes at a time when they desperately need to be brought together. It is more than time that the West turned to engagement. The old adage, keep your friends close and your enemies closer, is never more applicable than in this instance. All these groups need to be drawn into dialogue. The world, after all, is facing enormous economic and resource crises, energy, water, food, from which in the end none of us are immune. There are many areas of urgent common interest which can provide all these groups and countries with a common agenda. We should be building on that as a prelude to more focused talks on the individual conflicts that require resolution. It's never easy to turn established policy round, but it has to be done, and I believe from all the talks I've had with various parties in the region that it can be done. Yet even now in the distance, there lurks a dark cloud which could be the biggest polarizer of all. A military attack on Iran, either by the United States or Israel or both, would not only, in my view, be destined to fail, but it would also turn the majority of the Muslim world against the West. Such an attack would be totally divisive and unacceptable. Politics and military interests, like nature, abhor vacuums. Unless the current vacuum left by the policy of isolation and polarization is filled, widening instability is almost inevitable. As it happens, Europe and Britain, if only we could bring ourselves to see it, could have a real and invaluable role in this region if we can show ourselves to be both impartial and unemotional in our guidance, and that is the antithesis of the policy of isolation and ostracization. It is now more than ever necessary to talk not just to our friends, but to our enemies as well. The time for engagement has come. Thank you very much. Now I'm going to ask Alistair Crook, who I'm sure many of you know, and I don't need to have a lengthy introduction, to say a few words as well. Alistair, I may say, is the person who's helped me to meet most of the people I have met in the region over the last years, and I'm very grateful to him for the help he's given me. He's the founder of Conflicts Forum, which is an organisation based in Beirut, and I think doing enormously important work in trying to bring these sides together. He's a former special Mideast advisor to the European Union High Representative Javier Solana, and he also worked with Senator George Mitchell when he was asked by President Clinton to see whether he could, at that stage, do something to take the Israeli-Palestinian process forward. He has mediated negotiations leading to the ceasefire declared by Hamas and Islamic Jihad in June 2003, so he knows more about the problems than I think I will ever learn in a lifetime. I'm delighted he's with us today, and I'll ask him to address us.
Thank you very much. We talked, and the main subject was really about engagement. And I wanted to actually speak a little bit about the process of engagement, and also how I think the process of engagement, whether there is or there isn't, is another issue, but how we look at engagement, how this has changed over the course of the years in which I've been involved in it. Why engage? Well, I think the important element of it is clearly about managing change, about seeing and how to deal with change. I think it's been quite striking. In the 2 weeks that I've been here, and I've visited Brussels and Paris and Oslo and then in London, I've said to everybody that the region is on the brink of change. I think Michael mentioned that in the talk. Some of it is political change. The center of gravity, if you like, of the Arab powers is swinging away from Saudi Arabia and Egypt in a different direction. The Islamist movements are changing, as Michael said, towards, if you like, away from a narrow base and towards a much more broad-based struggle against what they see as the occupation of the region more widely. But equally, there are other changes that have nothing to do with governments and state organizations. And I think we tend to get over-focused on the state role. But I'm talking about price increases. I'm talking about the financial crisis. I'm talking about the fact that the prices in Lebanon, for example, for people living on staples have doubled in the last year. Prices have doubled. People can't afford to eat in many places. The number in absolute poverty in Egypt has gone up from about 15% to nearly a quarter of the population. By the World Bank standards, that means less than $2 per day per family for income. It's even in rich Lebanon around 30%. I can't tell you what it is in Syria because it's not very easy to know, but I can assure you both in Syria, Jordan, and even Saudi Arabia, the impact of this first stage, and I believe it's a first stage, of the financial crisis is having a huge impact. And of course there'll be implications from that change. Whenever you say this now, I come to London or you go to Brussels and you say, we're on the edge of big changes in the region, people say, oh, that's terrible news. You've made us so depressed. We really are pessimistic. And I'm really quite struck by how often people say, and now say, change is somehow something that is ultimately to be seen as something to be avoided at all costs, that this is something that is a cause of huge pessimism, that the status quo, any shift from the status quo, actually threatens our security, is the suggestion that has come from this. I think some of these problems we can see even 30 years ago in probably one of the second peace process or political process which I was involved with, which at that stage failed, which was in Southwest Africa, Namibia. We saw the fact that the West was not really very good at playing an impartial role, as Michael was advocating, in that particular context. By which I mean the international contact group was ready, under pressure, to acquiesce to the South African demonization of SWAPO, both as a terrorist organization and as a Marxist organization. Charges which subsequently proved to be erroneous. There was no Marxist socialist government that followed it. They were also acquiescent in the setting up of a Pretoria-friendly puppet government in Windhoek in order to try and push through a constitution that would be acceptable to the status quo at that time towards South Africa, and acquiesced throughout the period until it collapsed in about 1980 in the process by which the, if you like, the observer, the international process of elections was eaten away until effectively it was under the guardianship in all but name but of South Africa, with the UN reduced to no more than a role of certifying that this was a free and fair election. So there is a history, if you like, to the inability to manage change in terms of our actual processes of engagement. We are inclined to stay with Western national interests, to always support, if you like, the more powerful of the two in an asymmetrical process. And I see many, in fact, all of the same characteristics, the same ambiguity, constructive ambiguity that was present in Namibia, being practiced today in the political field in Palestine, without any change at all, essentially, in that process. There are many more parallels. But I think something else has come into this, and this, I think, is part of the changes that have taken place in the United States. And we've seen ideological and also a change that has come from the Christian element of the Republican Party. I think we've seen the idea that human beings can bring about, if you like, a discontinuity in history, that there can be clean breaks, a removal from past sins and past flaws of society, and that by a human effort that this could change into a new society, a different society, a democratic society, a liberal society. I think history shows there are few examples of real discontinuities of this type. But I think this Christian, if you like, heritage which was taken up by the forefathers in the United States has created, if you like, almost a sort of redemption politics and a redeemer nation who sees itself in the role of having to bring about, as Michael said, certain visions of the institutions of the state and of the outcome that is necessary to create the redemption and move away from this flawed past and this primitive past that these countries have faced. I think this has also been, if you like, compounded by the economic theories of Milton Friedman. His idea that a sufficient shock to societies could create a tabula rasa, that you could clear away people's old sins and old mental attitudes, and on that you could write a more clear neoliberal economic structures and systems in the chaos that ensues, but in the shock to the psychology which allowed these new social and economic systems to be written. I think in many ways, therefore, we have an engagement process that actually mirrors this. In many ways, it is an engagement process that is a neoliberal one, which presupposes that there have to be shocks and rewards for entering into a process. And it is not surprising, as Michael has suggested in this, that all the recent agreements in the region have therefore been have been conducted without the influence of the West, or indeed of the European Union. And I think it reflects two things. I think it reflects, first of all, a feeling that the Western engagement is in itself polarizing. Not only simply that the West has a polarized view, but actually the type of Western engagement is itself now polarizing. I think it also is reflecting something which I think the West needs to think about much more seriously, is that as the people in the region, let us move away from the sort of politics of Hamas and Islamism and all these sort of polarized language that we have much more here. As the West, as the region, looks at the problems that it's having with a nation-state structure, sometimes it looks and thinks its country like Lebanon needs something that is looser, flatter, more flexible than perhaps a Western system. As they look at the economic impact of globalization, as it has affected the region, as they look at the social structure of based around individualism in the West, increasingly they see the models of the West and the models that, if you like, are integral to our process of engagement as not being as helpful to them in finding their own solutions to their problems that they are dealing with. So I think that even if we manage to persuade, and at the moment I think we are in a period of absolute denial, I think it is the denial of change, and we see the denial in many features. I think we see the denial in the sense of a denial that the inevitable outcome of the first Gulf War, collapse of the Soviet Union, and the demise of Iraq was a preeminent Iran in the region. Irrespective of the nuclear issue, I see no signs of Western leaders or Israeli leaders being able to come to terms with how to manage this change in the region. I think we see the same denial in the issue of Islamism. Islamism, of course, will be one of the beneficiaries of the economic crisis that is affecting the region. When people can't eat, when their life is destroyed, they will turn to Islam and Islamist movements. The challenge facing them is to provide a social and economic vision that can deal with this problem. And I think that there is a denial about the fact that the Israel seems unable at this time to make a two-state solution viable. But that has certainly huge consequences, because if we remain with a policy of unilateral assured destructive capability in Israel, and yet it is unable to make peace with its neighbor, this becomes a center of great, if you like, instability in the region. So all these dynamics are going to be there, irrespective of who wins the American election, in the view of most of the leaders of the region. These are changes that are already underway. It doesn't matter what happens in some sense in the election. But even were there to be a change in attitude, I fear that it will be unsuccessful, because it's simply not going to work. The process by which under this, if you like, neoliberal approach to diplomacy, of coming and with sticks and carrots and a sort of path through which people, human beings, are supposed to go through to reach the desired end from the point of view of the West, to come to Iran at some point and say, okay, let's cut a deal. What's your bottom line? What can you give us? And we'll see what we can give you. Let's get down to it and cut a deal. Because the reply of Iran will be something like, no, I'm very sorry, but I think you misunderstand. This discussion is about respect and dignity. And the response from the Western negotiators will be, well, how do we negotiate respect and dignity? What do you expect us to do about that? Well, one of the things that I believe that is missing, and why engagement, if it happens, may indeed, on the present way in which it's approached in the West, only lead to further failures is simply because we don't stand back and look at the question and say, well, why do the Iranians actually want to put these questions? And what does that mean? And how do we respond? I think in some sense you have to have stages in negotiation. You can't simply come to the table with a Hamas or Ahmadinejad and say, come on, what's the bottom line? Tell me what you want. It's going to need a much more sophisticated process of understanding the mechanisms of change and how to deal with those changes and be ready to deal with those changes. And of course, how can you begin to understand those changes if you won't speak to Iran and you won't speak to Hezbollah and you won't speak to Hamas? Thank you very much.